Watch this.
Do we agree who was bringing the vim and who was bringing the vigor?
I don't have either. So if Bruce brings the vim, I think, Sam, you can bring the vigor. What have you been bringing recently, Sam? You brought the, what was it? Pizzazz.
Pizzazz. It was pizzazz and guile. I wasn't sure which one I had more of. We agreed neither. Okay, Bruce, you're running point on vim. Let's get going.
Okay, hello and welcome back to another episode of the Cookie Jar Golf Podcast, brought to you in partnership with FootJoy. I am Tom Mills, and today I'm joined by my two esteemed colleagues, Bruce Fitzpatrick.
Good evening.
And Sam Williams.
Gentlemen, what a pleasure. Can I kick this podcast off, Tom, with just the sheer disappointment of being a, you know, being a branded athlete of FootJoy and not being able to get my hands on a pair of the Buscemi's?
It has been raised. They are a good looking shoe, though. They're very good looking.
Absolutely gutted.
I can't say you deserve a pair, having referred to yourself as a branded athlete. I think that is a hangable offence, but they do look quite nice.
Not only are you unbranded, you're not even an athlete, so it's kind of a real pickle. Yeah.
I'm not the biggest athlete in Cookie Jar. Anyway, how are we doing, gentlemen? We are obviously going to here to talk about the players, which is going to be a good lead into Augusta National in a couple of weeks' time. But how are we generally before we, you know, a bit of a check-in?
Good, I think. Days are just getting a bit longer now, aren't they? You know, like, really does feel like we're kind of in the run up to the proper season. The weather is still a pretty mixed bag, but I'm excited. Like, this is just, I think it's the combination of the better weather or longer days at the very least, and then, you know, seeing some slightly more interesting golf on tour just gets you up for it.
Have you been playing much golf, Bruce?
Played a little bit. Had a card in hand for the first time on Saturday for about 9 months, 6 months, whatever, which was
how did that go?
Better than expected. Yeah, it was all right. I kind of sort of shoveled it round, as one of our previous podcast guests referred to. It was good fun. You guys been playing much? Sam, you've been out to Spain, haven't you?
Well, we're in Spain with the guys from Sounder a couple of weeks ago. I've had a good run of it of late, actually, and then managed to get three games in last week. I was at Little Aston with a couple of friends, went up to Moortown, podcasting coming soon. Duncan McCarthy, what a guy.
Looking forward to that.
You know, performance coach to, I don't even know what it's called, golf psychologist, performance coach, I don't know where one stops, next begins, the likes of Ashley Buhai, Mel Reid.
I liked when he called himself a mental coach, because to me, that seems like a coach who's mental. You know, when you see like, all sorts of things like that, you know, manager special, that sort of thing. But mental coach, it just, for me, that kind of...
Well, anyway, Moortown was a delight, wasn't it? It was an absolute delight. And then on Friday, I had Jack Salas from Halcyon Golf Travel. Mm. Played a few holes with him and his colleague, Lee. And he bloody jarred it on the ninth, didn't he?
Amazing. Saw the story.
And it was a class hole in one as well. Because the greens are soft, there's no run. Yeah. He's dropped this thing over the top of the flag. I thought, God, that looks so good. And it's not going to run, is it? So, you know, he's sent this thing right over the top of the stick. We're like, you know, holding our breath. And it's obviously, and it's just dropped in the hole. Gone up, marked this pitch mark, and it's 3 foot past the hole. It's a bloody good player, plus four. Wow. And actually, that was his last day of defense as the current champion of the Lord Warden, which you competed in on Saturday, Bruce. So, it's a virtuous circle.
And I suppose he's not been on the pod, but a mutual friend of ours, Nick Smits, who's gone and won that. And congratulations to Nick, because that's a good event, isn't it, Bruce, down at Rye?
I think so. I mean, you know, I sound like a broken record saying how much I love Rye, but we all love Rye, obviously. It's a special place. Aside from the course being a great test and actually probably having the best day of the year, with it being pretty pleasant, sort of 10 mile an hour wind, if that, nice and sunny and warm. I mean, the greens were like 11 on the stimp meter, which is just so hard to get your head around with the weather that we've had over the last few months. It was unbelievable. And yeah, great. You know, it's a great field from Rye and the St. Port, so Deal, Littleston, Royal St George's, and a few others. Quite a small sort of intimate field, but everyone, you know, kind of plays it in a great spirit. It's competitive play, but we play at a decent pace. And I think this has got to be probably the distinguishing feature of it, is you sit down and have a full jacket and tie lunch halfway round. And then, you know, it's a pretty tight turnaround. And then you get kitted up and go back out for your second round. So it's 36 holes of proper straight play golf with a jacket and tie lunch in the middle. What's not to love?
It's not bad for Marsh, is it?
Yeah.
That's doing all right with getting the timing with the light and all that. But
yeah.
Oh, nice. And how did you fare? Is it not worth mentioning on the pod?
I played all right. I didn't do great in the first round. Sort of stumbled to an 80, I think, which wasn't brilliant. And played pretty similarly in the afternoon, and was 9 shots better, just on the virtue, I think, of just holding a few putts. It's weird, isn't it? I mean, it's hard to get your head around. Like, you don't feel like you play all that differently from one round to the next, and yet the difference in your score can be quite dramatic. I think, yeah. It set me up for, you know, like having a bad round, a good round, at least having it that way around, finishing on a slightly more positive note kind of gets you wanting to come back for more. So it was good. Yeah.
Which is almost an incredible segue of holding a few putts with what's gone on this weekend. So with Scheffler, suddenly found the flat stick. It's now like seems unstoppable, doesn't it? It's like, did you guys watch? Obviously, we're here to talk about the players. How much of it did you get to watch? Sam, did you get to watch a lot of it?
I probably caught an hour or two most days. I watched pretty much everything yesterday. It's weird, isn't it? Scheffler's. I mean, maybe we should just start first off with the tournament.
Yeah.
Smallgrass looks so good, doesn't it?
Like, yeah.
It actually does. For a podcast that absolutely bags penal architecture, it absolutely looks sensational. And it's just a great tournament. It's the absolute perfect balance of being, I suppose it's almost like the love child of the Phoenix Waste Management and the Masters, you know? It kind of has the perfect theatre.
Push back. Well,
I suppose how's it like Phoenix? Well, I think the theatre of 17, I think, is probably what I was reaching at there. I do think that works brilliantly. I think it's a great field. It's a shame there's a few big names missing, obviously, with Liv and stuff, but it's a really big field. And it is one that seems to generally produce like an unbelievable leaderboard. Like, you know, you look at the players that are playing, they are the best golfers in form at this moment in time. It's a very good representation of who's playing good golf on tour right now. So I thought it's a great tournament. I think, you know, they slightly yipped it earlier on in the week when they put this tweet out of everyone firing up lawnmowers and you could see them hosing the rough with chemicals.
Yeah.
I think Andy Johnson tweeted it or something saying, I don't think I could imagine anything that would make golf look less environmentally friendly than this. But yeah, bloody hell, the course just looks absolutely immaculate.
Yeah.
I saw something on the PGA Tour that put up like some pictures of it, of Sawgrass in the 80s and it now, and I mean, it had like that sort of really yellow builder's sand in all the bunkers and all that stuff. And like now it's that crushed marble, white, pure, mega pure look of the bunkers. And it's all just so refined. And I think the thing I like about Sawgrass, certainly as a tournament, is I think there is horrendously difficult golf holes and gettable golf holes in equal measure. Which I think is what makes it quite interesting. Like that round the turn, there's some gettable golf holes, and then 14 and 15 quite tough, and then 16 obviously is, you know, she's basically a four for those guys, and then 17 looks fairly terrifying, 18 looks absolutely mind-blowingly terrifying, if you ask me.
I think there's jeopardy though. I don't even know if I would say that it's like it's gettable and also really quite penal. I think it balances that like the whole way through, basically. So even, is it 12, the drivable par four? Like,
yeah.
You assume that a lot of them are going to make threes there, but if you pull it left, like you're just making bogey. And it's the same on 17. Like if you come out of one and you fan one. And it's really epitomized by the 17th, isn't it? In that it's like a pretty modest yardage for those guys. But, you know, it leads to so many double bogeys and but a lot of birdies too. You know, you kind of summed up with them. With how Wyndham Clark played it on Saturday and Sunday.
Yeah.
I mean, that really final, the final group on 17 was, I mean, it was quite good, wasn't it? And they both put it to what, 8 feet? Nine feet.
Well, they kind of had to, I suppose. That's kind of what I was going to say is I saw quite an interesting thing on Data to Golf, which is obviously the shot dispersion for a right-handed player, which is predominantly long left and short right. So that pin that they tuck behind the bunker on the Sunday is just an absolute, it's a red light pin, I suppose, isn't it? I'm pretty sure.
I don't know, it's just
not an accessible pin. So they're having to pick, you know, and equally they can't go too sort of central on that green because they just bury themselves with a three putt. It's quite interesting looking at sort of what the statistician would say you'd go for. But yeah, it's an epic golf hole. And if you hit the putting surface, you've got half a chance. And if not, you're just dead, aren't you?
I mean, the scoring was remarkably good all week. I think the moving it to March is definitely, I shouldn't speak so confidently about things that I don't have a full command of the statistics over. But I do feel like there's probably a trend of the scoring having improved since it's been moved to a March date. And obviously there was, you know, just low scores the whole way through the week. Wyndham Clark just went berserk Thursday, Friday, and Scheffler backed it up with 64 on Sunday. So, like, it's definitely exciting golf. And I think for a tournament that probably historically, and you mentioned it there, Sam, been seen as quite a penal golf course, where you can rack up some big numbers. I don't think anyone's really talked about the fact that it produced such a great quality leaderboard without embarrassing players like a US Open style course necessarily might. Which I thought was interesting.
Rory went absolutely berserk on day one, didn't he? I mean, there's a few players in the field. Matt Fitzpatrick, another one, Rory one. They've just got an inordinate amount of birdies across the whole week.
To your point, Tom, it does yield birdie chances, but there is jeopardy there. And if you walk the high line with that, you know, constantly, you are gonna take a lot of chances in the process. I think Rory kind of went out day two, didn't he, with 10 birdies on his CV and thought, you know, let's go for it. I think we've got to kick this off with a proper dissection of Scottie Scheffler, though.
I mean, the key headline there is that it seems to be that a bearded Scottie Scheffler is undefeatable. He's won his last three starts with a beard, hasn't he? So the Hero World Challenge, was that back in November, December, last week at Bay Hill, and then here he ended the players. I'd love it if he shaved off next week or the next event, just as a
bad juju, wouldn't it?
Just turned up to the Masters, just clean shaven. I've just gone on rampant rage with a beard. Be absolutely atrocious.
But I've got to say, like, I think he's just the most sort of endearing world number one sports figure around. Really, I've got to say, like, I think he's absolutely top notch. Not just in terms of, you know, the phenomenal golf that he's been playing really for 2 years now. Just the way he carries himself, I think he's brilliant. Like, he gets quite intense and animated at times on the course, like, you know, fist pumps and a few, you know, sort of, you know, very expressive. But I just think the way he handles himself in the press conferences is brilliant. He sometimes gets drawn on, you know, what do you make of the LIV and the PGA Tour split? He gives great answers there, which I think are a little bit more measured than McIlroy, maybe, dare I say it, slightly more well thought through. But probably more than anything, you know, earlier in the week when they said, like, how do you sort of stay so grounded? I thought he gave a brilliant answer there. I'd urge everyone to watch it because not only do you, like, thank the interviewers, like, oh, I think that's a really nice compliment, so first off, thank you. He then just sort of went on to talk about how, like, he basically just leaves what happens at the golf course behind, and he's got a great sort of family and home set up. And he's like, yeah, talking about Bay Hill, where he obviously won by 5 or 6. He said, yeah, if I'd shot 75 on that Sunday, I don't think my Monday would have really looked any more different. I might have had slightly fewer texts to respond to on my phone, like, you know, me and Meredith and my family, and we're still just going to have a great time. And you think that is a remarkable perspective. Yeah. For a guy who is without doubt the best player in the world.
I can assure you, his bank account would be different. Seeing what he's done in 8 days.
Yeah.
8.5 million in 8 days.
Yeah, but he just seems such a likable, affable, normal guy in spite of it.
I actually found myself pulling for him. I'm not a big Scheffler. I wouldn't call myself a Scheffler fan. But coming down the stretch on Sunday, I actually found myself, I wanted him to do it. I don't know why. I can't put my finger on it, but I wanted him to do it.
Was that because he was coming from behind and just the idea of like a big come from behind charge? You just think, yeah.
Yeah, maybe. And then I can't say I'm the biggest Zander fan in the world. Like, he just seems just emotionally disengaged. I don't know if that's the right term, but he just seems very kind of, you know, it's interesting because I imagine if Zander won or lost, and you know, that if he got the same question that Scheffler got, his response would have been very similar, and that is he would have been quite boring on Monday. Whereas I actually quite like Wyndham, the grit coming down, that he was winning me over towards the end, because he really wasn't playing very well, and then, you know, just really dogged it out, sort of 16 17 18, and that lip out on 18 was absolutely absurd.
It literally looked like he'd been shot, didn't it? It looked like he had been shot. He was exceptionally
unlucky, really. I mean, it's a prayer's head away from going in the hole, isn't it?
A prayer's head. The ball was going 5 feet past.
I think it is very, very hard not to be in complete awe of Scheffler, like the way he plays. And like you say, Bruce, you know, he is a grounded guy. He seems a bit more distanced from it. He doesn't seem to sort of want to insert himself as a huge spokesperson. He seems to be a million miles away from controversy. So naturally, you know, off the course, he's not someone you're talking about on repeat all the time, thinking, oh, you know, he's done this, this has happened, you know, there's no need for a take on him. He just kills it with competence. Like, when you see him hit shots into short par four on the back nine, I'm going to get this wrong, I want to say it's 15, or you think you said it's 12. I've slept since then. You know, you just watch him hit the absolute perfect golf shot when it's required. And there just seems to be almost no kink in the ball striking. I suppose what's strange, though, is since he's changed the putter, he's gone on what seems to be an even greater tear. He was almost untouchable when he was putting miles off being sort of a top 50 standard putter on tour, and now he's sort of got that. I mean, don't get me wrong, he's not had the best week with the putter. You know, he's won comfortably, but he has won, and he's come from an unbelievable sort of distance behind. I wonder what would happen if he was putting the lights out and it was the driver that was the fault, and then he corrected the driver. I don't know whether we would be talking about it with quite the same reverence, but either way, it's astonishing. Like, the way he's playing, it's very hard to imagine anyone beating him, even on a sort of 7 out of 10 day right now.
Yeah, and it, you know, for as dominant as he's been tee to green for the last 18 months, 2 years, you know, the stats are out there for everyone to see. Like, he's basically first in the ball striking categories, apart from this week where he had a slightly dodgy neck and everyone was like, oh, he's got a dodgy neck. He's second in the ball striking categories this week. You know, that's a shame, isn't it? But yeah, having said that, like, the kind of the motion and the move is all obviously a bit ungainly and the footwork's a bit mad, but like, the guy just backs it up with relentless shot making and consistency. And then to your point there, Sam, when he gets hot with a putter, he wins by 5 or 6 like he did at Bay Hill. It's remarkable.
But his strokes gained, I mean, just on the field in basic areas, I mean, is absolutely absurd. I mean, off the tee this week, I think he was 6.7 or 8, something like that. And I mean, when he's not getting strokes gained on a scratch golf, you know, he's doing strokes gained on a PGA Tour field. It's just like, if he can start to be average in everywhere else, then, you know, you'd still win by a margin with that sort of dominance off the tee. I mean, he just looked like I don't get it, because he looks like, with the footwork and everything, it just looks so ungainly, but it's just absurdly repeatable, which is, that's the remarkable bit, how repeatable it is when all the parts are moving. So
it looks just incredibly dominating, doesn't it? It just looks, you know, you're watching the other players and you just know when he's got the best stuff there. There's no one that can really live with him over 4 rounds. Like, I just,
although
just
having said that, here's this is for a stat from Justin Ray, who's obviously the, What's his handle on Twitter?
I don't know his handle. Golf-dated
guy. Yeah, but anyway, he's obviously just remarkably knowledgeable about the stats. He said he'd been back through 50 years worth of PGA Tour data and couldn't find an occasion where the winner and the runner-up were the same in successive weeks, which is what's happened here with Scheffler and Clark going 1-2 at Bay Hill in the Players.
So yeah, he found it in like 1964 or something like that.
Yeah.
And in the end, he found it. Yeah. It's mental.
Which
is strange because you think back to the dominance that the big three had, and you would think that just they came in, you know, together around the same time at some point, but no. Mad.
I think, yeah, I was saying like on Wyndham Clark, just to move the conversation on a touch from Scheffler, I do find myself warming to him a little bit actually as well. I think that's partly informed by having watched like Full Swing, and there's quite a good story there, I think, about him just being an absolute hothead and sort of turning it around with the help of a sports psychologist. And it's quite, you know, I think it's brought together quite nicely in Full Swing actually. And you know, he is a bit more outspoken without a doubt than Scheffler. Like the comments that I think, you know, pissed a lot of people off when he was heading into the Ryder Cup last year, and he was like, yeah, I'm the best player here on either side.
Yeah,
just that wheel, bravado, machismo, and then he goes and loses to like Bob McIntyre in the singles, and he's thinking, God, this is not a good look, come on. But this year he's come out like all guns blazing, obviously like shot 60 at the AT&T at Pebble Beach, and he's had two really, really solid weeks. I can't believe how hard he hits his putts. Like it's just nuts.
Yeah,
isn't it? That one on 17 as well, like full kudos to him having hit a complete chunk. I was surprised he held the finish on Saturday and he just chunked it in the water, and then to back it up on Sunday by like knocking it in close and just taking all the break out of that putt and ramming it in.
Going in the water if he misses that.
Yeah.
Putt.
Like,
did you see the comment though in the media on the Saturday where someone said, oh, tell us about the water ball on 17. He's like, well, you know, don't want to blame a caddy. But, and then decided to go, went on a sort of semi rampage about how it, like they were torn between pitch and gap, and or it was gap and sand or something like that, I think even. And he was trying to go easy on a gap and he should have hit it. It was just like, yeah, I was talked into the wrong club and I tried to, it was like, it was just ignore everything before, but he just threw him right under the bus. So
he's an absurdly strong player though. And you look at the way he hits that golf ball. I mean, if you need birdie down 18 at Sawgrass, like there's no way you're pulling iron on the tee. It's just no way.
He hits that iron like, I think it's even a
270.
Iron. But it's like, yeah, 260, 265, something like that. It's just
he hit
like...
He hit four iron wedge into a 450-yard par four over water. I mean, it is absolutely...
Under the gun as well.
Yeah, I mean, he's obviously got a bit of adrenaline going through him there, hasn't he, to do that. But that's just nuts. Like, 450-yard hole, he's covered it with a four iron and a pitching wedge.
I mean, it's
ball's not going too far, though.
I think I've got an irrational dislike of Wyndham Clark because I really wanted the US Open to be interesting, and it wasn't because Wyndham Clark was too dominant. Do you know what I mean?
I really wanted
that tournament to be good, and it just wasn't because he just absolutely... just crushed the field. And I really wanted him to down Sunday, I really wanted him to kind of mess it up, and he didn't. And ever since, I've kind of held a grudge.
He didn't crush the field, mate. He won by one.
No, but he was like five up, wasn't he? Like, it was never going anywhere. He just kept...
No, it was massively in the balance of the US Open.
Yeah, do you remember?
He won the bund.
No,
he had an air shot on his final round. I mean, it's...
Yeah, yeah. McIlroy was there waiting on the final green. You have to get down in two from 50 feet. Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a misremembering of history there, Mills.
Oh, right. Okay. Well, maybe just I didn't want him to win. Maybe that was it.
It's interesting, though. You've both drawn on something you've watched recently, and it's probably hugely influenced by the Netflix documentary, which I don't know. It was okay, I would say.
I haven't seen it, so I'll have to push back.
Oh, well, you haven't been influenced by it, then that would make...
I need to watch. Do I need to watch it?
I think it's 100%. Good,
you run a golf podcast. I think I would highly encourage you to engage with
but
any
level
me, of the sport.
You've got me chained to a desk making reels all day. I mean, when have I got time to watch a Netflix documentary? Is it worth a watch?
Yeah. I saw a really interesting take on it by, there's a great Twitter account. If you're on Twitter and you don't follow, an account called Wokenzie, W-O-K-E-N-Z, whatever. And he basically just paraphrased the latest Netflix documentary series saying, you know, really enjoyed F1. If you want to see the latest version of Full Swing, it's basically, you know, privileged tour pros whining about Liv, which was really the subtext of the vast majority of the entire series. I know there was bits with Ryder Cup and there's stuff with, you know, Tom Kim and all that, but I suppose thin would be the way I'd sort of describe it. It's maybe just a bit thinner. It didn't feel quite as fulfilling as watching last year. Maybe that's because the excitement of the, you know, the first series coming out and seeing what that was going to be like has kind of somewhat waned. I don't know.
I didn't really enjoy the first series, which is why I haven't dived into the second, which is strange because I really like Drive to Survive. But they also did a rugby one that wasn't very good either, didn't they? The Six Nations
rugby
one.
was really poor.
I'm just going to go on a limb here though, Mills, and I reckon you're probably a bit more proficient in the performance or the playing of sports like golf and rugby than you are with, you know, F1. I don't know, maybe you've had a career as an F1 driver that I'm not aware of.
100%.
You've had a career as a golfer. Yeah.
But the stuff that kind of irked me a bit about Full Swing season one was like defining what a birdie is and a par, and like that's just like, you know, that was like ick territory.
It was also really hard to define. Yeah. Like they managed to make it like 20 sentences long. It was just really difficult to define what, you know, they were trying to reference it in terms of like expected score and all that stuff. But I think you've hit the nail on the head. I think these shows are really, really good at introducing people to sport, to a particular sport. Whereas I think if you, you know, there's always that guy that takes off like the Drive to Survive. The dude, the journalist is always on it. And he's like, if you want to win, you need to be the fastest. You know, it's just all like cliches and just stupid shit like that. Yeah. And, you know, if you know loads about F1, I'm sure you're like, yeah. I mean, who doesn't know that stuff? But that's why I've not really watched Full Swing.
But nonetheless, it was a really, I mean, like that is, for all the moaning we do about professional golf, that was about as good a PGA Tour event as you'll probably see in the next 5 years, I'd say.
Quick word on Xander. I think maybe merit a bit of conversation, do you reckon?
I do kind of subscribe to Tom's view of the world. He's just a very difficult guy to root for. It all seems so mechanical and quite robotic. And I think he's just naturally drawn to players with a bit of flair. Like we were joking about what the difference between guile and pizzazz was, whatever, before. We established I have neither of those qualities. But I just feel like watching Xander, it's all so drilled into him. And he's so competent. I mean, I saw in the broadcast, he's got the longest running cut streak on tour right now, 42 events, hasn't missed a cut. He's consistently there. Like he's always in the mix, really.
Really.
And he doesn't seem to win at like a crazy clip, does he? And I suppose, is there a little bit in there about, you know, just stellar competence, but just no real sort of, that's something to just get it over the line when it really matters.
Je ne sais quoi.
That is the funny thing. I agree with you, Sam. Then I look back and he's won 7 times worldwide. Like big events as well, not majors or the absolute headline, but they're like, you know, good quality fields. Just haven't done it for like a couple of years, I want to say. And it's weird because his game is obviously there, but he seems like he's not been able to get off this sort of streak for a good while now. And although he's won it several times, it's actually like a less extreme version of McIlroy's sort of major issue that he's got. He's won 4 majors, but people think, like, you know, he can't win one because he hasn't won one in 10 years, basically. And I think it's like a little bit of that with Xander. I agree with you on the like the not really warming to him, but I think in my case, I'd probably just put my hand up and say that it's because I sort of associate him with Patrick Cantlay too readily.
Yes.
from the Ryder Cup.
100%. I was going to say that, like, I find it really hard to not think about that Ryder Cup stuff with, if rumors to be believed, you know, they were kicking up a big fuss about not being paid and all that stuff. And it's really hard to not associated with that sort of stuff. So I find it difficult to go for him. Another person I found difficult to, pull for maybe a year ago, but now is Brian Harman.
I thought you were going to say that.
That's a great take.
And, you know, coming back to stretch again, I was like, go on then, boy. Get it done. Go and get your bow out. Get it done.
How did I know there was going to be a hunting analogy in there? I mean, there were so many pages that are just littered with that stuff, aren't they?
No, but I have warmed to him. I have warmed to him.
Sam, he's I can't actually
deadly
believe.
With the putter, but I actually am quite... That, well, I was so in the anti-Harman camp, wasn't I, for so long, because he's a bit more covered now, I suppose. But before then, I'd only seen him as somebody that I thought was just a bit of a bad-tempered oik on the golf course who just seemed, you know, like a yappy dog who, when things weren't going his way, wasn't very happy. And that's not the Brian Harman I've seen since the... Certainly around the Open and since. And he's a hell of a player. Like, you know, he's just quietly going about it. And I think in some ways it's quite endearing seeing somebody who's got quite a few critics out there, certainly around the Open Championship. A few people who, even when he went on and won the Open, I still think put him down as maybe perhaps a weaker winner. Like, oh, he's not really like that level of winner that we expect to see at Hoylake in previous years gone by. And he's just like, not listen to it, just carry on, keep turning up, keep doing the business. And he's there all the time.
Mighty wins, mighty champions. What I like most about Harman that week is like when we was in the press conference, like on the Saturday, certainly Saturday, maybe even Friday, was like, you know, all the people going, well, you know, Hoylake's got it's going to have the longest back nine in Open history. And, you know, it's going to be quite difficult for you. And he just kind of stayed quiet for a bit. And then someone was like, actually, Harman can get it out of there. And he's like, yeah, well, I'm not sure. I'm just not going to tell you that I'm not sure. You all just assume I'm a patter, but I can get the ball out there. It's okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, he rips it. I mean, he absolutely rips it. And he's deadly with that, whatever the hell is on the end of his putter. I mean, it's enormous, that thing he uses.
All lefty swings look good, though.
They all have the same move through it. I've never quite figured it out.
Bruce, you're just not as discerning, are you? No, but you don't see that same like flash of geometry that you would see with a right-handed player, because your brain can't quite. You when you mirror them, you put them on swing software and you mirror them, you look at Phil Mickelson's move and you're like, fuck me, how has this guy ever broken 100? Because it's just so wild.
Really?
Sorry. Yeah. I shouldn't have got so, you know, animated about it. But when you flip it around, it looks very, very different.
But they all look like they slide through it, don't they, with the lefty? Do you know what I mean? It's just you've obviously started, you know, flipping video footage around to sort of really dissect.
No, I haven't. I've just seen people who have and consume that information. Let's not, you know, come on. Yeah, there's a bit of like there's a bit more legs to it. Certainly with Phil's swing, like that's more of an 80s kind of motion, is it? Like a bit more legs and kind of reverse C finish, as they might call it. Harman actually, I think probably does swing it quite well.
Harman, you know, is quite definitely, he's definitely a contender for worst captain as well. Did you see that at the end?
Yeah.
I think Scheffler comfortably took that. That was incredible tan lines.
I don't know, Harman's was because he's a cue ball as well, like you. It's kind of really difficult, like for them. He went so red, sort of down the face, that when he got his lid out, it was quite a stark contrast.
It does feel like though there's a set of players that are just playing at a significantly better rate than anyone else, particularly in, maybe that event just put a spotlight on it. You know, I don't know, but. Great tournament. I don't really know what else to add to it. I think it does feel like it's just got very interesting all of a sudden, doesn't it? With now rolling into the Masters in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
And the shame last year was that major season was over and done with so quickly. And
that's not going anywhere.
Cherish it for the next few months.
Yeah. It just feels a bit weird, doesn't it? In that you just, like, I don't know about you guys. It seems to me very few people are watching LIV and are just very few people are engaged with LIV golf. And
I think that's objective. That's not subjective.
Like, yeah, but the result is now we're going into the Masters. It's like, if you want to have a bit of a punt on someone or just chat about who you fancy, it's like, it's just so hard to compare those two tours now. Like, I don't really know how. I was chatting with Harry earlier. about Cam Smith. He's like, yeah, I think Cam Smith's got a good chance for the Masters. I'm like, I don't actually know what Cam Smith's form is really like over the last however many months, because you just sort of so detached from it. And Rahm, just an absolute world beater, has gone over there. And again, we just, okay, we see that like Joaquin Niemann's won a couple of times, and there's some chatter around Anthony Kim's return, but it's such a bizarre place to be in, where there is, it almost feels like there is a 60-40 split now in terms of the talent pool in on the PGA Tour and 40% over on the LIV Tour. And yeah, the majors as a result are just even more important.
I think if you look maybe at the best 20 players in the world, you know, what's that, 8 players? Maybe a bit less. Maybe there's a bit of VAT on there for Bruce, but
yeah,
you know, there's a good fistful. You know, your Brooks, Cam Smith, Rahm. I mean, Niemann is comfortably playing like best on that tour at the moment, isn't he?
Yeah. And DJ. I mean, DJ, yeah, was DJ. A world beater, but he's been over there for 2 years now, so people sort of forget about him.
I remember you saying on this podcast 2 years ago, the thought that we would be forgetting DJ in conversation. I mean, Molinari, you know, what a guy needs to do. We've forgotten him within 12 months. You know, we'll never ever lose sight of how good DJ is. And now we've done it. It's taken 2 years of golfing irrelevance on LIV, but we have just dismissed DJ in this podcast. There's an unbelievable amount of world beaters on that tour.
I hate to say it, like Patrick Reed.
Bryson.
Patrick Reed and Bryson. Oh. These guys just aren't in the conversation.
And they've basically got South Africa as well, who always over-index in major championship golf every time.
Patrick Reed. Are you guys follow his Instagram?
No, actually.
Oh, my Lord.
Since his wife stopped running it, whatever.
It is absolutely glorious. Because, like, he'll put shots of himself up and they're like, can you believe the shot on this? And it's obviously been put up by himself, but then he has to disable the comments straight away. So like sometimes like you can get hold of them if you react quick enough, because people are like, why, you know, why you, all the comments that roll in, he has to disable it like almost immediately. He has to disable it. If you can catch it in time, it's brilliant. You're going to get onto those comments, but he has to just disable it. It's so bad.
But he's persevering anyway. He's trying to,
Well, they've got their own image rights over there, and they're in control. They can. I think that's part of the deal. That's what Phil wanted, wasn't it? They can NFT their swings and all that stuff.
Yeah. I think we're on topic. Obviously, there was a couple of comments on that front, the LIV PGA front. You know, Jay Monahan was heckled, I think, pretty audibly at the presentation ceremony last night, wasn't he? And McIlroy sort of jumped presser? To his defense.
So everyone was jumping on it, saying it was like one of the worst presses in history.
He's just still trying to talk about future with the PIF and working together. And Rory came out and was like, look, I think the big issue is that there's this sort of disconnect between LIV and the PIF. And he's like basically saying, I think that the spokesman for LIV, i.e. Greg Norman and his sort of, you know, associates, are doing a really bad job at actually kind of projecting the PIF message. And actually the PIF is like, you know, McIlroy at the very least thinks that there's much more of a chance of collaboration there, and there could be a more productive future working with the PIF. But LIV is sort of just this kind of weird off spin that you know, not many people sort of seem to kind of enjoy or like the idea of working with. But then again, like the PGA Tour's done a massive deal with the Strategic Sports Group, and so I don't see how it all fits together. And I think that was probably what people were driving at there when they talked about Monahan's press conferences, is like there's just so little detail here, and he's just kind of giving the same answer over and over again. He's like a bit of a caricature, really.
You know when you're a kid and you have that dream that, like, I don't know, you go to school in your underwear and you kind of like, oh, you know, that sort of that realization, you're in the middle of like the school hall in your underwear, and it's like, oh fuck, like, and you're so like concerned and worried and like, well, what do I do in the panic? He looks like that boy in his underwear that's just been caught in the middle of a school hall, just panicking. Like, oh my Lord, what do I do? Like, how do I get out of here? You know, he just looks like
he's lost the room, hasn't he?
He just looks perpetually panicked.
Hate to think what someone could do with a bit of editing of that soundbite there from you, Tom. God, I mean, yeah, the analogy was spot on, but it wasn't one that I was thinking of. He does just seem like deer in headlights.
That would be a better way of saying it. Yeah, I suppose that staggered. Would be a better way of saying it. What's interesting, just circling back a little bit to that comment about, you know, 40%, let's say it's arguable, it's 40% of the world's talent pools currently at LIV. It is still an unwatchable product. And I don't know why.
I do. Actually, I think I could hazard a guess.
Go on then. What's your number one? You can only give one. What's your number one reason for why it's unwatchable? Because I think we've all got to have one reason why it's unwatchable.
Okay, I was going to say the YouTube broadcast, but actually I think that is a function. I think that's a function of how bad the commentary is. So I would say commentary.
Do you think it's commentary that does it?
Just actual broadcast, commentary, that sort of thing, yeah.
So I'm going to jump in here and I'm going to say it's the shotgun start. I think that totally and utterly ruins it. And I'm not talking about the podcast. I'm talking about the way they play completely lacks any context with the shot. When you're following that group on the Sunday final round at the Players, you know, because you're watching groups ahead go through those holes, what the jeopardy of the shots are, where the trouble is.
Yeah.
You know, the context of, okay, he's dropped a shot on 14, but we know that's not the end of the world because we know we've got, you know, a par five, you know, he can make two on 17. It's not out of the question. When it's just arbitrary sort of shotgun starts, it's impossible to keep track.
Yeah.
And I think therefore you can't actually get into it. So all you're watching is just a litany of golf shots every 5 minutes, occasionally with that sound bite when the ball lands in the hole.
Yeah.
Tom, what's yours?
I've got two. I'm like Bruce. I've only allowed one, but I'd say it's lack of atmosphere. Like, I think when you flick on DP World Tour, you get the same thing. It's like people could be hitting lights out shots, but then you get into a smatter of applause or whatever. And and it's like, okay, yeah. Like, not even anyone who's there is getting up for this, let alone me on TV. So
they're just smashing hard seltzer and going around and like jumping on some inflatable toys, aren't they? Like, it just doesn't look like a golf event.
I don't mind the house music on 24/7. Like, I don't mind that in the background. I mean, golf's boring enough. I don't mind a bit of that. But I find it really hard to watch, and I don't know why.
I think, yeah, to your point though, like that, the house music playing does actually like cheapen the atmosphere. Cause I think trying to bring a few things together, like it's the fact that there's this silence that's punctuated by shots and then applause or cheers or boos or whatever, when you're watching the final groups, you know, come to the climax of the Players there. Like if there was just house music blaring out while they're all stood on the 17th tee trying to hit a shot, I just think it would lose it. But the fact that you've basically got this silence and all of a sudden someone hits a shot and it's like, oh, what's going to, you know, that all just leads to the kind of tension mounting. I think you have like this kind of compression and release of like, you know, the whole sort of atmosphere there. But yeah, I think Sam, you actually probably have nailed it with the shotgun start point, because I mean, the idea of like Wyndham Clark and Schauffele teeing off on one and then like another group teeing off on two, but finishing on the first, like the whole, like the whole flow of a golf course, you just lose it, don't you?
Yeah, because you don't know. Are they backing into easier golf holes versus a tougher stretch? It's completely lost. And to your point, Bruce, like that, I suppose, really good commentary might save that a bit. But the commentary is so focused on peddling brand LIV. So it can't think for itself now.
I'll tell you where they really shat the bed, though, is even with everything they're doing, they could have made it remotely interesting if they truly embraced team culture and got the women involved and done, you know, brought that in, or had some foursomes or had some four ball golf or something that's something to do with the team.
Yeah.
But they've decided to go men only. 54 holes. That's the gimmick. It's changed. It's like 54 holes. There's nothing to do with a team. It's four individual dudes just playing golf. And it's so removed from a team. It's like, it's just watching. Yeah. It's just nonsense.
I would love to see Anthony Kim 65. I need to try and hunt that down, because I think that could be one of the all-time great rounds this year.
Yeah, and then when you're done with that, maybe go and watch him try and qualify the Asian Tour Series, where there was actually a cut and he missed the cut by 8.
Yeah, T-130th, wasn't he, or something?
you're bagging it. He couldn't have played any better in the first two events, could he?
Of Liv, yeah. He couldn't have played that well. But it's just...
What do you mean he couldn't have played better? He was hitting shanks and duffs.
Well, no. Like, you've got to imagine where he's starting from.
Yeah,
like,
12 years off and he's not touched that the in. Club. He doesn't know how far he hits the ball, does he?
I get that. But the dude is accepting, got them off the rack. The dude is accepting cash to play golf in a public arena. Like, shame on him. It's not like you can't expect him to do better.
Well, no, you can't possibly expect him to go out there and compete with the world's best. He's literally using clubs that are off the rack. He didn't even get fit for the clubs. It's just he wants to use his old clubs from when he was playing
Caddy's like trying to work out the yardage, isn't he, on the way around? He's like, yeah,
he's got no fishing blind. I mean,
but in a way, kind of cheap.
He did a drop over his shoulder, didn't he?
I don't know. I just think he tried. He dropped his shoulder high. But like, it does sort of cheapen the story a bit, because I don't know whether this is just a sort of hopeless romantic in me thinking, oh, Anthony Kim, you know, what an absolute talent. And he was robbed of the prime of his like professional career by injury and the kind of guilt of having to take this payout. And God, when he's given this sort of like new lease of life by Liv, he'll just be practicing hard. He'll come out and he'll just kind of pick up from where he left off. And it's like, no, actually, there's something a bit more sort of, I don't know, sinister going on there, where he's like, not sinister, but it's just not that romantic. He's like probably left golf behind. He's been offered a boatload of money. He thought, yeah, come back. He's been hooked up with some clubs off the rack. He's probably not hit any balls or done any practice before the first round. Like, does golf even mean that much to him anymore? I don't know. But yeah,
I'd actually fall in love with the story though. If he just said, yeah, it's just, I'm never going to get it back, but I'm going to play in these events. I'm going to play in all of them, but I'm not going to practice at all. And that would just be epic to watch. Just
is he part of the team or is he like a freelance?
No,
free
he's a wild card.
Rogue agent. Yeah.
Is he like a free agent?
I don't want this to turn into a Liv pod, because it is consuming far too much of what's been a sensational week on the PGA Tour.
Just one final point on it. It does make a mockery of the whole, of them trying to prove that they're not an exhibition by adding basically an exhibition golfer in there.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
He's the definition of an expert golfer because he doesn't practice.
Anyway,
can I round this out with a few Scheffler predictions for the year ahead? Is this a period of form that is going to use Bruce? Well, these takes will almost certainly age like milk, but will it? Are we going to be sat here in 6 months' time going, crikey, I did not expect him to pick up three out of the next four majors?
That's hard. No, that is like, you know, probably a bit unfair to put that on him. I mean, he sustained a level of ball striking that no one's done ever. If, you know, Tiger for a little bit in 2000, obviously had the putting as well to back it up. It's just, yeah, I could see him just like maintaining absolute dominance as world number one and picking up a major. Anything more than that, there's just so much on timing, isn't there? And the quality of the field now is so stacked. I'd love it. I'd love nothing more than if Scheffler just went on an absolute blitz and won the three out of the next four. That would be awesome. But I just think it's too tall an order.
He's never done tremendously well in the Open. Just if that's the one you think he's going to miss. But, you know, well, he's finished...
It doesn't seem beyond 23rd. Belief that he'll win in 2 weeks' time.
He
won it last year at a canter.
It just feels like...
He four-gifted it for the win, didn't he, on 18?
In 2022, yeah. It feels like there's no kink in the armour, doesn't there? Just... apart from the putting, mate, you know. Thing is, it's just so hard to say. I think he'll win two.
Can I just offer an opinion quickly to finish it up though? I can remember us talking about the Tour Championship last year and doing a roundup on Hovland. And it's amazing how quickly these people fade from memory. The guy was on an absolute tear at the end of last season going into the Ryder Cup. I can't say I know what he's been up to recently.
I know what he's been up to. He's going through a swing change.
He finished one under.
He's gone through a swing change, isn't he? Is that like considering like he was unbelievable last year?
Yeah. He shot two over in the final round.
Rebuild his tight swing.
It's nuts, isn't it?
Like you say, comes in, goes, doesn't it? But I do feel like the ball striking at least does seem to have endured a hell of a long length of time with Scheffler. Where it's like, you know, maybe we see a period of dominance and maybe we see him in 6 months and go, God, that was a really heavy few weeks he had, and he's still a great player. But actually, but at the moment, it looks emphatic, doesn't it? Gentlemen,
wait, before we go, here's a question. Is the players a major?
No.
And I know that sounds stupid. Is it the next best thing to a major?
Yes.
But I don't know what that really means. Next best thing. Like,
it's definitely the best event, I think, on the PGA Tour.
You think?
Yeah.
Comfortably. Very comfortably, I'd say. It has all the feels of it. It's a great segue into the major season, though, isn't it? A couple of weeks before. It's an excellent event. But there is only scope for so many of those. If we had, you know, if we had 38 players' championships in a year, we would naturally become desensitized to it. It needs to be as good like that. It needs to be as good as it is for us to appreciate it against the, you know, the cognizant or whatever, you know. You've got to have the downs to have the ups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think if Siwoo Kim had gone and won by four shots and Jake Knapp finished second and you had a couple of other people who were kind of not that well known, then maybe we wouldn't be speaking with such reverence about it. I do think with a lot of these things, it's like the quality of the field and the quality of the finish that sort of sets the tone, really. But yeah, that, you know, it's nice that it's a course that we have familiarity with because we see it so much, and it has had, you know, form in delivering some amazing champions. But, you know, like there are just certain majors that just fall a bit flat as well. So I don't know. I think I'd,
like the US Open with Wyndham Clark.
No, I'm going to push back on that. But I'm going to suggest that the PGA Valhalla could be one of those.
Maybe.
You just never know, do you? That's the nature of this game.
Time will tell.
Quite random.
Anyway, chaps, we haven't done this in a while, and it's been lovely to catch up.
Where are we off to next week, Tom?
Well,
Bruce is working. We're going to be.
Well, Bruce is working 20-hour days. You and I, Sam and I, are going to Wales, and we are going to sample the delights of my homeland. Highlights include, but not solely, Welsh Pool, Aberdovey, Pennard, Royal St David's, Tenby,
St David's City, Borthyn Innes Lass.
Oh yeah, Borthyn Innes Lass.
Honestly,
so it's going to be eight courses, 4 days, with four of us heading down there. So it's going to be good fun. Which, because I haven't really played a huge amount of golf in my homeland, I've sort of picked up the game after I left. So I'm excited. It's going to be good fun.
Do you think there'll be people with banners at the border? Do you think there'll be people there stood on the borders, just sort of with
checking passports? Well, you remember your passport?
Really, yeah? You and Jamie Donaldson now, isn't it? Maybe Woozy as well.
Yeah, Woozy still got it. Woozy still looks sort of man.
Sounds like a hell of a trip.
Bruce, what have you got coming up? Any big events?
Well, there is the Varsity Match at Rye this Friday, Saturday. I think it's the 135th playing. So I'm hoping to try and get down there and watch some of the action on Saturday morning. It's very exciting. And then, yeah, just sort of, you know, trying to get around, practice a bit, play a bit, start, you know, getting up for the season. It feels like May is when it really gets going, and it's actually not that far away now, is it? I mean, this year's just gone by scarily quick, hasn't it? So yeah, but sadly no trips to the glorious Welsh Hills for me. I'm going to be looking at the story and following your travels with real envy, but I hope you have a great trip.
Perfect. Well, chaps, it's been an absolute delight, and I suppose until next time. Oh, Bruce,
I just
want to back of the classroom, Bruce.
One final shout out. I think it would be remiss not to just say a big shout out to the captain of Chislehurst Golf Club for breaking the sort of golf social media
and someone's nose.
I hope that the spectators involved weren't too badly affected by it. I don't think anyone was really badly hurt, as far as I can tell. But first off, like, what an unbelievable turnout for a drive-in in March. Like, quite remarkable.
Popular things, these drive-ins.
I didn't think they were. I didn't think that was a real thing, but hey ho. Yeah, if you're looking for a bit of light entertainment on your sort of your Monday. Well, this is coming out Tuesday, isn't it? Tuesday morning, I would just go and check that out. It is searingly good content.
And to recap the headlines from the week, your champion golfer of the Players' Championship is Scott Scheffler, and Nick Smits is your Lord Warden champion for 2024. Congratulations to both of them.
Until next time.
Adios.
Watch this.